Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of QSR Uncut. I'm your host, Danny Klein, the editorial director here at QSR, and joined by my colleague and co-host, Ben Coley. So this week, you know, I actually think, then, that we have done a lot of podcasts with bowl concepts, and I couldn't tell you why that is, other than I think there's a lot of growth in that segment. I think they're fun to talk about. They're places that I actually would eat, which helps the conversation a lot of times as well. But we're joined by Ryan Thorman, the founder and CEO of Bengal Bowls. So, Ryan, first of all, thank you for joining us. I want to, before you get really into, you know, some of the nuances here, just give us a little bit of background on yourself, you know, about the brand. Maybe tell us the origin story, and we'll take it from there.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on, guys. Big fan of the podcast. Been listening to quite a few episodes. So Bengal Bowls, we've been around for about 6 years now, going on our sixth year. Myself, personally, got started in the technology space. I worked for LinkedIn and in software sales for about 5 years before coming over. This was kind of like a side project, side hustle, if you will. My partner is the true restaurateur, has been in the space for a long time. So we kind of started this concept together as just an idea. And it grew rather quickly to the point where we really started to invest a lot of time and effort. And at that point, I decided to leave my software sales job and jump over as the CEO of Bengal Bowls. A little bit about Bengal Bowls. You know, we are in the better for you space, as you mentioned. One of the key differentiators about us, though, is that we have a lot of diversity in our menu. You know, while we are a bowl concept, you know, we focus on a few different categories, including salads, grain bowls, poke bowls, acai bowls, and then smoothies and a few other items. You know, we always say that the diversity in the menu is one of the key differentiators, along with, you know, the amount of value we put on the quality and flavor of the food, along with the health benefits.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I feel like there was always a very typical kind of restaurant story of people who were in finance getting into the business. And now I think you see a lot of people who are in technology now getting into the business.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is? Yeah.
I think you saw that in business in general. In the past, you'd see a lot of COOs come into being a CEO, whereas now in today's world, the last five to 10 years, you're seeing a lot of CMOs become CEOs, you know, and that's a trend. I think because, you know, marketing, digital marketing plays such a large piece of driving sales and driving revenue, right? Which is such an important part of any business, but the restaurant business is not any different from that. So I think as technology adapts and becomes such a bigger part of our life, you see a lot of people focusing on that and then taking that next step and moving, you know, into something else. In this particular case, it's food. You know, food's a big passion for a lot of people, myself included. So I think that's why you're seeing that transition.
Yeah, well, Danny, I was going to say, you know, Ryan is very much correct what he says about the CMO thing, you know, moving up into leadership. But we've seen that so much. I mean, I just talked to a full service brand last week, Buddy's Pizza. The CMO of Marco's Pizza came over to lead that brand. I think the CEO of Pramati Brothers, another full service chain CMO. I want to say over at Arby's, leader of Arby's was a CMO too. Rita Patel, I think she was a CMO of Buffalo Wild Wings.
Also, the Papa John's CEO is he's a marketing guy too.
Yeah, so it's everywhere. Yeah,
so there's quite a bit. And I'll say, coming from the tech space, like a lot of things that were being spoken about in the marketing space 5 to 6 years ago, maybe even a little bit more, are what we're starting to see in the restaurant space now. You know, so that time period when I was in tech, you were seeing a lot of CMOs become CEOs, right? And now, as we're trailing a little bit behind, it's a little bit of a slower and older generation in restaurants. You know, we're starting to see that same trend take place.
So I'm really interested in being a tech guy. Then we'll kind of get into the growth of the brand, but I mean, when you deal with all these vendors and, you know, different, you know, aggregators and people who are, you know, basically trying to offer you solutions, and you're speaking their language, which I think is probably pretty interesting. I mean, has that helped you kind of, you know, can you sit there and go, you know, I know what you're saying is, you know, is nonsense or something like that? I mean, do you have a little bit of an uptake on kind of the general restaurant guy who's maybe just looking for help and is trying to find a partner, but, you know, really doesn't have any, you know, background in that and is, you know, sort of navigating dark through it?
Yeah, I think it's helped quite a bit. You know, I think there's a few points to what you bring up there. It's helped because in years past, it was really about like making sure you're using software. Whereas now it's not just about making sure you're using software. It's about making sure you're using the right software, because it can be super challenging and super expensive to make a mistake. And then, you know, you have buyer's remorse. You see a new shiny toy come up after you just spent 6 months getting your online ordering platform built. And then it's like, oh my God, this is not the right one. This new toy is so much better. So the evaluation process of choosing the right softwares is, you know, really, really hard. And that's why, you know, I think for the size of Bengal Bowls and where we are today, you know, our tech stack is actually pretty well established, and I believe in a pretty good place, you know, with all things in our business. But on the other side of that, you know, there's a limitation to how much tech and how much software you can use from a financially responsible place. You know, like the restaurant business is still tough margins, like that has not changed. So you can't just endlessly add tech. You know, like I know there's a cool solution for everything, but you still have to go through a real evaluation process, not only for if the software works, but hey, like, is this financially feasible? Like, does my P&L still work if I add 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 new pieces of software? So like, yes and no. And then the last thing I'll say is like, end of the day, the restaurant business is about good food, clean restaurants, and great service. So like, you can't lose sight of that while you need technology. And I think we are very technology forward at Bengal Bowls. You know, those three things, those three guiding principles are obviously so important as well. So you can't let tech make you or help you or enable you to lose sight of, you know, the fact that we're still in the restaurant business.
Before we get into the growth, you know, I want to back up a little bit, you know, to the origin of, you know, your guys' name. It's very like punchy. It's very quick. Like you say, Bengal Bowls, like very fast.
What's a bango?
Yeah. So I was just curious, you know, it's a very unique name, very punchy. You know, what was the origin of, you know, coming up with that title?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's extremely cliche. You know, we were kicking around the concept, and I literally woke up one morning and I was just like, bango, bango, bango. And I kept saying it and I kept putting it with other words. And I was like, this is the most marketable word ever because you can just put it with everything. So like, you know, we have menu items that we use it. Like we have a smoothie called the Bango Boss. Our proprietary acai it's called the Bango Bowl. We have, you know, multiple things throughout our restaurant and our culture that revolve around using the word bango. And it just goes with so many things. I was like, this word is extremely marketable. And it's just kind of, it was an idea. I mentioned it, everyone loved it. And then it was like, we just kind of rolled with it. So it's not, you know, I don't have an unbelievable backstory. I was just like, I love this word and we could really roll with this.
so it's kind of like bingo, bango, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Like you've already said it 4 times. It's fun to say, right? Yeah. Like the key thing, you know, when we first got started is, you know, we made our number one product, the Bango Bowl, right? Because we wanted people to pick up an acai bowl and go to work and someone say, hey, what's that? Not have somebody say, hey, it's an acai bowl from Bango Bowls. We wanted people to immediately say, this is a Bango Bowl. So now like that, you really see that in offices. Like, what do you have? Oh, I have a Bango Bowl. I have a Bango Bowl. Not an acai bowl from XYZ. So that has helped our marketability and kind of get word of mouth and all that.
Right. So we often ask this of, you know, fast casual brands on here of just kind of taking us to the early days of growth. You know, so have a good idea, you get a good partner, you have kind of a good background in how to get started here, but, you know, out of the gate, always challenges in this industry. I mean, what was that first location like? I mean, did you have an idea you wanted to build more than one? You know, how fast did that come? And what were just kind of those early, you know, moments on the job for you?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. As I mentioned, like I started this as kind of a side hustle. Like I was still working in Manhattan, living in Manhattan on my 9-to-5. Our first location was actually attached to a tap room, which I mentioned was one of our other concepts in their hospitality group, which is a full serve gastropub. They had this little 300 square foot space next to it. We kind of kicked around the idea of doing acai bowls out of it. long story short, we ended up doing it. Said, okay, this is our first location. We opened up this first store in 2017. I think it was January 1st, actually. It was dead of winter, snow on the ground here. And we opened up the doors and we were just doing gangbuster sales, like crazy, doing $6,000 a day out of a 300 square foot space. And we were like, oh my God, like what did we find?
How many bowls is that?
It's a lot. I mean,
Jersey Mike's always refers to it as breads. You know, they say like we sold 800 breads per store, and it took me a minute to realize what they were talking about. But
yeah,
I mean, that's got to be 400, 500, 600 bowls or something. Yeah.
It was like nothing I've been a part of. It was just wild at that point. Like Acai was just coming on the scene. Like there weren't a ton of people doing it. Like for us on Long Island, there was just one other person on Long Island, nowhere near where we opened, who was doing it. So like once we opened, literally the doors just, you know, there was a line down the street every day, which is wild, right? Especially in the winter. So, you know, we were like, oh, we got to move fast. This is amazing. So we opened up a few more locations pretty quickly. And then we quickly realized that like, hey, there's a little bit more to this. You know, there's more of a competitive space. We need to really take a step back and focus on what the vision is for this company. And, you know, at that point, we really decided that like we wanted to play in the better for you space. You know, we wanted to focus on menu diversity, not solely rely on a singular product. But we wanted to create a menu that allowed to have something flavorful and good for you for the entire family, and really focus on that veto vote, right? So like we're open for 3 day parts, which is pretty unique. And we have something for the entire family. Like if your wife wants to get a salad, if I want to get a poke bowl and the kids want to get an acai bowl, like that really plays to, you know, our ability of what we're doing and really differentiates us. And we focus on doing those things that in simplified fashion and in really high quality.
Yeah, I'm looking at the menu right now, actually. It is pretty extensive for sure.
You know, speaking, I was going to ask this, Danny, you know, during, you know, the tougher parts of COVID where it was harder to, the supply chain was kind of all a mess. I would imagine that you guys having a diverse menu must have been very helpful when it came to that. I was wondering if you can kind of take us back to, you know, those tougher days of COVID and how your menu, you know, and the diversity of the menu kind of helped you guys out when it came to, you know, supply chain and getting your guys' hands on ingredients and all that such.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, COVID, as bad as it is to say, was really an accelerant for us because our business is 95% takeout. We operate at a pretty small footprint, 1,000 to 1,200 square feet. And obviously with the technology background, we were doing a lot of the things that other companies weren't before COVID. Like we already had online ordering all set up. Like our whole operation was all driven by technology, ticketing systems, everything like that. So once COVID hit, like we didn't have to figure anything else out. We just had to try to figure out how to get more customers in our door and to try our food. Right. And since we had this new menu iteration and we were doing all these different categories, it was really like perfect timing to get people in to try some of these new menu items and to really prove that, hey, these guys aren't just acai bowls trying to make it with this other, you know, bad food. Like the same detail and attention and quality is going into everything in their menu. And it's awesome. Right. So that really helped just accelerate our sales. We didn't have too many chain, you know, supply chain problems, like just like everyone did. It was more about your attitude, you know, going into it. It's like everyone's got supply chain problems. Like, can you wake up every day and try to fix it? Or are you going to, you know, sit back and feel bad for yourself? Like we always, you know, our business is built on a positive mindset. Like we always say that, you know, so the same thing carried on through COVID. Like every day we're out of something new. And what are we going to do to fix it? And how are we going to keep going?
You know, you're looking at your franchising website now. I'm sitting here researching you during this conversation. But your average unit volumes are actually, I mean, they're closer to like a sandwich chain than a bowl chain, which I think reflects probably a lot of what you've been talking about. But so I guess briefly, you want to kind of talk about that opportunity. You know, I know that's more recent in terms of kind of looking to the future of growth, but, you know, why franchising?
Yeah, so we have 7 corporate stores now. You know, we've been in business for 5-6 years. We have always gotten inquiries, always gotten questions about franchising, and we were never really going to go down that route. It was always about, you know, trying to grow this thing from a corporate standpoint. And I think a big part of that was, like, at that time, I was the operator, the owner, bookkeeper, literally everything. So I was like, there's no way I can imagine doing all this and also starting a franchise concept and helping franchisees, right? So as we got a little bit bigger, we were able to put a little bit more infrastructure in place, and we were able to continue to focus on sales, you know? So driving sales and driving that top line revenue is incredibly important. And we didn't want to franchise too early. You know, we didn't want to say, hey, you know, maybe we're at that lower amount and there's really not that much skin left on the bone or meat left on the bone for a potential franchisee. So we made a conscious effort to set a goal of a top line revenue number that we are trying to attain. And when we got to that goal, then we'd say, okay, let's try to grow this thing from a franchising standpoint. So top line revenue and making sure that we had a support structure and infrastructure in place to support our franchisees was a super calculated and thought out thing that we wanted to attain before we offer franchises.
You know, Ryan, in addition to, you know, getting your top line revenue sorted out and getting support infrastructure sorted out, in terms of like operations within the restaurant and being able to replicate that at every location, which is what you would need, obviously, in a franchising system, how close were you guys, you know, I guess, back of house wise and how things worked in there, you know, I guess, quote unquote, franchisable, you know, as a concept and ready to roll it out to operators across the country?
Yeah, absolutely. I talked about some of that simplification, right? So like, we do have a diverse menu, but the technology we use in the restaurants and the footprints we have for our restaurants allows us to really simplify everything we're doing. You know, we're operating out of 1,000 to 1,200 square feet about. We have no grills, no ranges, no venting systems. We use a combi oven, a Rational combi oven, to cook everything we have. You know, our kitchens are no larger than 200 square feet, 300 square feet. And we have no, you know, trained chefs, no line cooks or anything like that. We're able to use the technology, you know, provided to us to train our teams and be able to really focus on the prep aspect of it and let the technology and the ovens that we're using really be able to execute on the final product, which enables us to provide more time on our guest service, provide more time on processing more orders because we're not bogged down in the kitchen. We're not dealing with a lot of those problems, you know. And then when you think about that from a franchise standpoint, it's like, okay, we have small footprints, we have high revenues, and we have small build out costs or low build out costs comparatively. You know, a lot of folks, you know, play in that 2,000 square foot range, 2,000, 2,500 square foot range. A lot harder to find those types of spaces, at least here in New York, where it is to find 1,000 square feet in New York. You know, we could drive down the street and find maybe 15, 20 in the suburbs here that are good potential fits for our Bengal Bowls. So from a real estate perspective and an operations perspective, I think we do have a clear advantage.
So going back in time, when did this stop being a side hustle for you? You know, yeah. When did it become the hustle?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think we got to, I want to say it was somewhere between 3 and 4 locations where my partners who were doing the majority of the operating. You know, I mentioned we have another concept, so we're growing that concept as well at the same time. So like between the two concepts, it just got to be too much. You know, we had a conversation. It was like, listen, if we're going to put this amount of time and energy into this concept, we really need somebody to kind of take charge. So at that point, I kind of took the leap of faith. I asked my wife for permission to leave my cush corporate job and join the restaurant industry and working long hours and make no money for quite a bit.
Yeah, what a good pitch that must have been.
Right? No, honestly, I've been with my wife since I was 15 years old. She knew once we got started and she could see how much I was putting into it, like it was only a matter of time. So she was great about it and let me kind of take that jump.
Yeah, and she was here for the long haul too, right? So,
yep.
You know.
Certainly not in it for the money.
Even if you had made a terrible decision, she'd have supported you. So I guess I try to think about that when I ask my wife for crazy stuff. But so tell us a little bit about kind of where the concept is at now. I think from what I saw on the website, you know, the same store sales are up in sort of that 20% range through the kind of through the COVID rebound into now. Obviously kicking off this franchising, but I mean, what are just some things about the brand, you know, in terms of the status check now? I know really technology, like you mentioned, is kind of humming along, good rewards program, things like that. Or, you know, where's just the trajectory of Bango Bowls, you know, as we sit here today?
Yeah, absolutely. So we just got started franchising about a month ago. We just officially got our FDD back and kind of started making those announcements. We've been teasing it for a little while. So now it's just about getting started and getting some franchises open, getting development started. We actually just hired a chief development officer who started last week. A lot of years and time in the franchise world to know it significantly better than us, right? Like as the CEO, like my responsibility now is one, you know, finding people who are much better at their roles than I am, right? And giving them all the tools they need to succeed and to grow. And then two, providing, you know, our new franchise business is providing the support that's needed and necessary to run a successful operation, right? That was part of the reason we waited as long as we did, because we wanted to make sure our infrastructure and support was in place. So those pieces are coming together. You know, I'm really excited about the next few months here, as I think we're going to start, you know, getting some deals done. We're having some really good conversations right now in the development process. You know, obviously same store sales are continuing to rise in our corporate stores, which gives us a good pulse of what's working versus what's not. And we'll continue to focus on our same store sales and continue to grow that, whether it's a menu innovation, whether it's new softwares or new technology we can use to make our guest experience better, our restaurants cleaner, or all the other things that help, you know, turn the dial and make us better as an organization.
You know, one question I ask a lot of our, you know, franchisors, in terms of growth, when it comes to these franchisees, there's a little bit of a different philosophy on how they go about growth. You know, some prefer, you know, to grow, I guess, like a bush, sort of like regionally, kind of like spread out from a center point. But then there are others who will follow, you know, experienced developer into, you know, maybe a region that's kind of further away from the base, and trust them to plant the flag in that other area. As you know, guys embark on your franchising journey, how do you envision, you know, franchising growth goes in terms of, you know, markets? So is it going to be more of like a building out the local approach, or do you imagine kind of branching out a little bit further?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, we're definitely focused on building out the local area first. You know, I think there's a lot to be said about having that brand power, brand recognition. You know, having our corporate stores already in place and here operating is going to help make a potential franchisee in our area that much more successful. With that said, you know, I don't think we're close-minded to anything. I think the right partner is really the biggest piece of it. And if we find a good partner that wants to operate somewhere else, you know, we're not going to be close-minded to that. We're going to have those conversations. But the focus for our immediate growth is definitely trying to focus on the tri-state area. We do operate in two markets currently, which is helpful. You know, we operate on Long Island. We also have some locations up in the Westchester County above Manhattan. So similar type of target audience, but, you know, definitely two different markets. You know, we're successful in both of those. So we have a lot of density here, obviously. So the amount of locations that we could open in the tri-state area is probably, you know, a lot more aggressive than somebody in a different type of area.
What kind of partners have you guys at least been seeing some interest from out of the gate? Because I think you mentioned earlier about being a 3-day park concept, and I think that's a pretty interesting thought in terms of, you know, if you're going to kind of maybe appeal to someone who's, you know, an owner operator type, you know, wants to be in the store all day long, you know, versus someone who maybe is tacking this on to, you know, for their portfolio, like you might see with some other bowl concepts that are, you know, maybe just lunch, you know, brands. But yeah, I mean, what kind of person has this been appealing to, or that you've seen as being a potential partner to grow?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a few different people that we've attracted so far. You know, the first is obviously the owner operator. Somebody's looking to maybe leave their corporate job or change their careers, or, you know, have the ability to be more involved in their kids' schedule, or, you know, has a desire to really get into the health benefits and the wellness scene, you know. So the owner operator is definitely a key piece of who we're looking for. You know, I think they're a really good fit. We're looking for an owner operator that probably wants to grow to a few locations, you know, somebody that has the drive and the acumen to kind of start at one, master it, and then get to a few more. So that's one side of it. And then, oh, obviously the multi-unit operator, somebody who may have some experience already in the food scene, who maybe already has a couple franchisee or franchises themselves and they're looking to grow their network, or, you know, they have a single mom and pop location and they're looking to try something else. You know, one thing about here on Long Island, at least, there's a lot of mom and pop type of organizations. You know, it's not as many chains or nationally known places. We obviously have those, but we have a lot of single unit type operators where, you know, their restaurant experience is great. Maybe they don't know how to run multi-units just yet. So that's somebody we're looking for as well.
So, you know, I've always found the health halo kind of fast casual category to be really interesting because the trends, you know, they move so fast. You know, you've got, you know, one day you've got, you know, quinoa being, you know, everything, and then it's acai, and then it's, you know, avocado toast, and then it's seaweed or whatever it might be. You know, you have something on your menu called protein toast, which is like the most on-trend item possible. But what is, from your perspective of the brand, I mean, what's like the, what's a health trend right now that maybe isn't getting as much love, but you think is on the rise, you know, that we might be talking about, you know?
Yeah, I mean, our concept is, as I mentioned, is built on positivity, right? And it's built on the ability to sustain a healthy lifestyle. So we focus just as much on the flavor as we do the health benefits of our items. You know, we are definitely not like, I would say the far right, but like, we're not all organic. You know, we don't not use seasonings. Like, we use salt and pepper. We use olive oil. We have things that sometimes may be a little bit more indulgent on our menu. Like, we use cornbread croutons for a while, right? Like, not the most healthy thing for you, but they taste amazing, right? So there are sacrifices we make, and we do that to appeal to a larger audience and to sustain that healthy lifestyle, right? Like I always say, if you want to eat healthy and you want to continuously eat healthy, you have to actually enjoy what you're eating, you know? So we really play on that. Like, we want the food to taste amazing. It also has to have certain health benefits, but if it doesn't taste good and has all these health benefits, then we're not going to put it on the menu. There's a fine balance there, which I think appeals to a larger audience. Like, we're not just trying to get the fitness fanatics, right? We're trying to make us available to people who are looking to make better choices, right? So we use that word better, you know, better for you a lot. A lot of people talk about the better for you space, but for us, it's about better choices. You know, it's not always about making the perfect choice. It's about making the better choice. So if we can get you to make the better choice more often, more consistently, it's good for business if you come back a lot, right? Like, we're not going to forget that. But it's also better for you. It's better for the person to make that better choice over and over again and actually enjoy what they're putting in their body.
Yeah, Ryan, that speaks to a lot of what I was going to ask next. And, you know, we talked about your background in technology, and we talked about, you know, being able to compete in a growingly competitive space. And you guys have a loyalty program, which, you know, I think is, you know, pretty impressive for, you know, a brand of your size, you know, having that infrastructure to attract customers and retain customers. And I was just hoping you kind of speak to your guys' journey with loyalty programs. I guess to, you know, put in a little plug there, at our upcoming QSR Evolution Conference in September, one of the panels that I'll be doing is on loyalty programs, and it's from a variety of people, you know, who've been kind of working with it, and, you know, what sort of table stakes and what's, you know, left to really accomplish, you know, in that kind of space. And I just wanted to get from your perspective as, you know, an emerging brand leader, you know, what factors that you feel are most valuable in that loyalty program to really, you know, attract a customer and increase that frequency.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, being the marketing guy, like, this is what gets me kind of jacked up and exciting. We started early with a loyalty program. You know, we've had a few, but recently, a year and a half ago, we invested in using Lunchbox as a third-party online ordering platform.
Our sponsors, we can shamelessly plug them again.
you know, they're using them. Kind of changed everything we're doing. You know, we use them. We use loyalty as our main marketing hub. That's like the true north of everything we're doing. So all of our data, once you order one time online, all of your data comes into our system, and that kind of feeds the engine, right? So our focus is to get you from one to three orders as quickly as we can. And we're able to do that with automations and marketing set up within the back end, right? So once you order one time, you're going to get an offer to come back a next time, right? Then you order another thing. We're going to use that first party data to give you another offer to come back that third time. So we know if we can get you from one to three orders, you know, in that first few weeks, like you're probably going to be a loyalist, right? You're still going to be a continued customer. So we're using that first party data to customize our messaging, right? Everything is one-to-one. The more specific you can be with a customer, the more likely you are to resonate, the more likely they are to come back. You know, so we're using things like, what did they order? How big was their order? Who do you think you ordered for? And do they have a family? Like, you tell by the sizes and all that type of things. So we have a lot of different segments built out, and we set up the automation. So, you know, it's just constant, and it's all working as a machine based on our customers coming in, right? Like, we're not just focusing on one monthly newsletter, right? It's all based on your personal data and your buying behavior. And that's what kind of sets the triggers to send out our automations and our messaging.
Yeah. I don't know if you listen to our podcast with Nabil at Lunchbox, but he really hates Westchester, by the way.
He does. White Plains, right? I think that's what he said.
Yeah,
White Plains.
Yeah, that's... I don't remember his reasoning, but...
Yeah, no, I do remember that because we have some stores up there. So I was like, why does this guy hate Westchester so much?
Yeah, as a former New Yorker, I actually have never been to Westchester, so I really can't speak to his eternal hatred for it. As long as the stores are doing well.
City guy for a long time. Once you're if you're like, I live in the city for 5-6 years, you know, moving out, it's definitely it's a change, right? So like, if you're not ready to change, you know, I was at the age where I was like, okay, I'm done with the city. Sounded like he wasn't quite done. But
yeah, I was that way at 18. I was ready to go.
Really?
Get out of there. Yeah.
That
was a different city back then as it is now, as I tell people. Yep. Especially Brooklyn. Totally different world than current version of it. Maybe I would have liked it more if it looked like it was now. I have no idea.
I mean, the food scene's pretty good. It's getting better every day, it feels like.
Yeah, it sucked when I was growing up. It wasn't good at all.
It's pretty good now.
Yeah. Well, what can you do? Well, Ryan, before we let you go here, first of all, thank you for spending some time with us. But if you want to give people a chance, maybe who might want to reach out where they could find you, you know, whether or not they're a prospective franchisee or just someone who's curious about a brand, you know, what might be a good place to get some more information?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we have a franchise development site on bangablowls.com, which you can apply for an application there if you are interested in a franchise. Obviously, me being an ex-LinkedIn employee, I am very active on the platform. So if you ever want to get in touch with me and have a one-on-one conversation, I respond to almost every message I get. I try my best to, at least. You know, so that's always the quickest and easiest way to get to me directly.
I'm impressed you do that because 80% of the messages I get on there are truly terrible. Ben was actually saying this the other day when someone starts off by saying like, how are you, Ben? You know, that's...
They'll say thanks for connecting. And they're trying to elicit a response out of you. And then they get into their pitch. So I've learned that process now.
Well, it was funny. I was telling Ben a story recently that some guy had tried to message me a few times and... I was ignoring him, and then eventually he goes, are you a real person? So I wrote, so I was like, oh God, I wrote back. I'm like, yeah, what did you think I was? And he's like, I thought maybe you were like a editor bot or something. And then it like worked for him to actually talk to me. And then we talked on the phone, and within 5 minutes he was like, I think I might've wasted your time. And I'm like, yeah, that's why I was not answering you out of the gate, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you definitely got to pick and choose. Like, you know, when we worked at LinkedIn, like I still believe in this. Like I make connections with people who I think I can learn from, or they can learn from me. Right. And I'm pretty selective about that. If you message me, I read through everything, right? If you message me and I think there's some value there, like I'm more than happy to have the conversation. I think I can learn a lot from multiple different people, right? But there's certainly a lot of noise, and you got to pick and choose who you want to continue to chat with.
Yeah,
I'm an ex-sales person myself, so I know the grind and trying to get people to have the conversation with that. So I try to keep that in mind and be as nice as possible.
I like the, I don't know if you get these, Ben, but I get a lot from like financial advisors, you know, yeah. who reach out and are like, hey, I'd like to, you know, spend some time talking about your finances. They work at like a bank or whatever. And I usually just reply like, you do know I'm a journalist. And then they say something stupid like, you know, oh, no, that's fine. Anything we can make, you know, grow for you. And then I just ignore them. But
yeah, I will say being on the 40 for 40 list on QSR was a double-edged sword. You know, the amount of garbage coming in on LinkedIn after that, you know, certainly went up.
I know that happens. I've heard that from other people, you know, and yeah. I'll actually, cause you know, we could track like emails that people send each other.
Yeah.
If they send it off our website,
yeah.
And I'll see with the 40-40 in particular, there's always just this huge bump in like, you know, suppliers and vendors and what have you.
It's like
send that to the person who's the CEO and be like, congratulations, you know, and then yep. I'm like, oh God.
It's the fresh meat list, right? Like, oh, these are all new growing scaling concepts that we can work with.
I know that's like both what's great about that list and why people really like it. And then also it is just open season, you know, for a lot of the people who read our publication who are not actually operators. So yeah. You're right. It is a double-edged sword.
Sure. It's all good. You get a lot of softwares. I use a lot of softwares. Like it's helpful to, you know, sometimes when people reach out, we use, end up making a connection and using it. So it's not all bad.
Yeah. To be honest, that's probably why we're here as a business. whether or not we want to embrace that head on or not. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, Ryan, thank you so much. You know, we appreciate you chatting with us. We'll look forward to seeing where the brand heads from here and, you know, best of luck with everything.
Thanks, guys. I really appreciate your time today.
And for everybody out there who's listening, as always, we appreciate it. We'll see you next time as well.